At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a compassionate guide for those seeking to heal and thrive. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach and fellow traveler on the path to healing. In this podcast, we will engage in heartfelt conversation with experts in the field of trauma healing. We'll explore ways to cultivate feeling safe in our bodies and in connection to others, so that we can be present to live the life we've been given more fully and with more joy. Join us as we navigate the way towards a life restored. Introducing your host, Monique Coven.
Welcome back, Ingrid. It is so exciting to have you back here for a part two, because a part one, we need more. We have more questions. No, it's never enough. I think back to my early days, or even before I even knew that I had complex trauma, and how I wished I could sit in front of someone and they could tell me or help me understand what is going on. So that's why we're doing this.
That. Yes, I'm so happy to be back.
Yeah. So we're talking about your book, and let me get it again to show people.
I love a show and tell.
Yes, I do. Fawning. And we're going to be talking again about what fawning is. And we asked actually the audience, both on Instagram and also podcast listeners, on what kinds of questions they had about fawning that they would like you to answer. So let's start with, I want to start in case somebody just has no idea, they're listening and they're going, what's fawning? Can you just give us again a simple explanation of what is fawning?
Fawning is a relational trauma response. So sort of an extension of fight, flight, and freeze, where you manage your relationships either through appeasement or caretaking to lessen the relational harm, ideally.
Yes. So relatable to so many of us.
Mm-hmm.
So before I start with some of the questions, just even as you were explaining that, my mind was going and I was thinking, I can think back to all of those times in my own life growing up where I knew that if I actually showed how I felt or said how I felt, something dangerous was going to happen to me. And I know, because actually one time I did express myself, and before I could even get it out of my mouth, I got it. And we'll leave it at that.
You saying that evokes those same memories in my body immediately. And it's making a really important point, is that the body tends to turn to fawn when the other responses are not available. So the body knows that fight is probably going to make things worse. And fight, what might be having a voice, setting a boundary, being a whole person in the world, taking up space, right? It's sort of this assertive stance. And the body knows, no, I've been burned too many times when I've tried to do that, or I've seen what happens when other people do. And so fawning kind of becomes this last resort. And yet it's still, in my mind, this really adaptive, genius, you know, shape-shifting kind of way of going, what does the environment need me to be so that I can stay safe? Because the body always prioritizes safety and survival over everything else. We're hardwired for it.
So we're hardwired for that, which means that actually our bodies are doing exactly as they were designed to do.
That's right.
And so what happens with our bodies, because they are this protective body mechanism, is that it really remembers when something happened and it was painful, traumatic, horrible. And it's almost like it's got this filing system that it knows when something similar happens in the present.
Yeah.
It knows, and it kind of goes back to what it remembers to be the safest response.
That's right. It's reflexive and it remembers. And because we're talking about relational trauma, which tends to be ongoing, right? It's not like a single incident oftentimes. It's it's your caregiver, it's your boss, it's your partner. It's these circumstances that we experience kind of breakfast to bedtime, a lot of us. The body not only remembers what worked last time, but over time, it's what we call chronic fawning, where it's like fawning is in the driver's seat all the time, no matter what. And this is where we're just fawning out of the gate. We don't even realize it. It's like guarding against potential danger in advance. And this is why we spoke to other reasons why it might be confused with personality, because it comes online when your body's developing. But it's also the chronic nature of sort of like, I don't know where I end and fawning begins, because it's sort of this perpetual safeguard that's like, I can't be my full self. So who do you need me to be? Even when people might be safe, like we lose the ability to even discern, which is so heartbreaking.
So heartbreaking. And you said that personality, I think so many of us then think this is what I'm stuck with. This is my personality. This is who I am. And I love that we're able to name, actually, this is a trauma response that we've learned and that is instinctual. It's not personality.
And oftentimes, I think this is another reason why it sort of feels hidden. It's hidden behind these sort of positive traits. It's like, but I'm just really kind and I'm really generous and I'm empathic and I'm patient. And, you know, a lot of us are all those things, but we don't know the extent to which, A, our body's being hijacked. And those are the hitch, so to speak. And they're at our own expense. We're generous and patient and kind to the extent that we're abandoning ourselves. We go missing, right? So it's a lot to tease apart.
So much to tease apart. As you were speaking, I was thinking that there must be so much physiology that's happening that can feel like fear at thinking about another way. You mean I don't have to say yes or be this way that I've always been, and then fear can come.
You say fear and my body feels terror. It's like it's literal life or death terror, right? And so many of our clients would echo the same. It's like, no, Ingrid, it feels like I'm going to die, like I'm going to lose everything, like I'm jumping off a cliff. That is what it feels like, because just as we've said, if your body only found safety, right? And again, this is the most important thing from a survival perspective. It's like safety at all costs. If you only found it through some level of caretaking or appeasement or shape-shifting, who do you need me to be? And now we're stripping that away. It's like a raw nerve. You feel unsafe. And then not only that, we're saying strip that away, but go do something else, like set a boundary. Go have a voice. Do the exact thing that probably got you burned. This is why examining this from a body-based perspective is so important, because otherwise we're continuing to shame survivors, putting them in greater harm with this supposed solution. We're not looking at it from a holistic perspective. And, you know, I lived in that for a very long time, and it was more harmful than helpful. And I refuse to continue to do that to people.
To take a breath for that, because because that is really, it's really something. So often I can remember in university, even when I took a class, I'm laughing because we used to role play in assertiveness training. So just take this training and you'll learn how to be assertive and speak up.
I wish it were that simple. I wish it were that simple. And yet it's completely discounting two major components of the equation. One is the environment. Oh, well, my environment is not safe, actually. The people in my life have benefited from my not being assertive, and they're not going to take to this change very kindly. I mentioned in the book, I have this friend, Allison. She's a writer friend, and we were talking just about the terminology of people pleasing. And she's like, Ingrid, people were not pleased, right? And there's this idea too, that when we stop, for those of us that have experienced some level of like it was working, when we stop people pleasing, people will not be pleased. And yeah, so it was discounting our environment. And again, what we've already spoken to is our physiology. So I wish it were that simple. I tried all the simple things. I read all the books. I took the questionnaires. I was dutiful. And quite frankly, after doing all of that and still finding like I didn't have access to my full self, my full voice, my sense of agency, I still felt trapped. Now I really felt broken, Monique, because I did all my homework and it didn't get me anywhere. So it doubles down on the shame that we're already holding.
So we can, even with what we've just talked about, see how those responses and then those responses when we want to take a step forward and get back to our authentic self can feel terrifying. That makes complete sense.
Yeah.
Feel so, you use the word terrifying, dangerous.
Yeah.
And yet the other way is really giving up of ourselves. And that's not what we want for ourselves. And that's not really living.
I've been referencing a lot lately, and I reference in the book, Dr. Rezma Menakem. He's the author of the book, My Grandmother's Hands, about racialized trauma in the United States. He's a brilliant speaker. And he references this term, clean pain versus dirty pain, right? Because what we're basically telling the listener is like, it's going to feel terrible. You're going to be terrified. Like, why would anybody do that? And I love this distinction that he makes. He's a somatic therapist. What we're talking about, this terror, in essence, is moving into clean pain. It's pain in service of moving through, right? It's pain that transports us into the place we've always wanted to be versus the dirty pain, which is the pain of recycling, of living in these chronic patterns. And it's painful either way. Let's be honest. The reason most of us come to this work is because we are living in some level of chronic pain. It might be physical chronic pain, emotional chronic pain. So I think framing it this way of like, yes, it's going to be hard. It's going to bring up a lot of stuff. And I received an email in my inbox this morning saying, Ingrid, no one's really talking about what feels so destabilizing when we stop fawning. It's sort of like the bottom fell out of his life. And what I responded was, I think you will see yourself reflected in many of the client stories that I present in this book, that unfawning initially can be synonymous with like an unraveling. There really is. And yet, how are you meant to build something new if you don't tear down what hasn't been working? All of these ideas, these metaphors can help hold parts of this process where I say, yes, it's going to be hard. It's going to be painful. There's an unraveling, but it's in service of reconnecting to building an internal sense of self that maybe you've never been connected to your whole life. And in my experience, every single step has been worth it. And my clients would echo the same. It's the reason they jumped at the opportunity to share their story for the book. They were like, oh my gosh, other people don't know about this and this framework and this way of thinking and being. And I want them to have that because it's changed my life for the better. You know, we don't end at the pain point, but it does tend to be part of the beginning.
I love metaphors too like that. And then I was thinking about what happened when we did some renovations in my house about 7 years ago. And we basically demolished the entire floor, mid-floor. And I was upstairs and I was hearing the banging. And it was bang because they were basically demolishing it. And I actually, my physiological reaction, I was crying. I was holding tight to a pillow. I was very, very triggered. And so this kind of reminds me that it was a scary process. I did not like going through it. It felt awful. What I now walk into is a brand new, spacious place that I inhabit, that I live in.
Wow.
So that's a really
good. Imagine you like on the second floor going, what am I doing? I'm tearing out the foundation that I'm literally resting upon. Like, it's terrifying, but you did it. And now you have this beautiful house. And that's exactly it. That's exactly it.
The banging was hard. It was really hard. But then I got to make my way into this new home. So I think it's a good metaphor. Okay, so let's get into some of the questions. We really could be here all day, but it's so fascinating. This is all in favor of PTSD growth, which I love because we always hear about PTSD, healing trauma. We're now talking about PTSD growth, which is what we're all on that path. I'm going to choose a couple of questions. So here. Can fawning be internalized in our bodies? And then it says, Ingrid, ooh, this looks like it's a question for you. Ingrid, you experience and heal your own physical chronic pain, fatigue, and functional freeze? If so, please share on this. I think they're asking you about your own healing
experience. Yeah. Tell me the beginning of that question again. I want to make sure.
Okay. Well, I think the first part, I don't know if it goes together, but it just says, can fawning be internalized in our bodies? And then it was, Ingrid, do you experience and heal your own physical chronic pain, fatigue, and functional freezes? If so, please share on this.
Wow. So I'm having to venture a guess a little bit what they mean by internalize.
Yeah.
And I a couple of things come to mind. One is just with this presentation of chronic fawning where we don't know where we end and fawning begins, to me, that's an internalized fawn response where I don't know the difference. I don't even know the contrast. I don't know a life without fawning. And so I think for a lot of us, this is true. And part of, it's so interesting, part of re-inhabiting our own body and having a sense of autonomy and agency is almost so that we can let the fawn response step aside, right? So it'll still be internalized. But in other words, we have a little bit of space between us and the reflex to fawn 24/7. I think that's probably a useful definition for what unfawning is. And then the rest of it, it feels like, you know, I know so many trauma survivors have experiences of these other chronic presentations, whether it's physical pain or other adaptations related to or different from the fawn response. And I actually think a lot of the work that I'm talking about in the book, even though it's specific to fawning, because it's that has gone missing from, I think, the larger discourse. I think a lot of the work is also helpful in a lot of these other adaptations and ways that our trauma symptoms have presented, because ultimately, when we're restoring a sense of relationship to self, we're restoring more choice, right? We're restoring more conscious awareness. And these are the seeds for all of the things that I think that person is asking about. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Meaning as we start to unfawn,
yeah,
does some of these things disappear or start to dissipate a bit?
Yeah. Yeah. The answer is yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Let's see. How do you recommend I prepare for interactions where I stop fawning, but there are potential dire consequences if I mess it up too badly?
That's such a good question, because it really honors the context that we're living in, right? I'm not telling anyone the goal is to go and say whatever is on your mind in every single context. Here's the thing that I want to highlight with that question. Excuse me. Sometimes we're still going to fawn, and I'm not mad about that, right? I've written the book. I've been studying this for a long time. I talk about this day in, day out. My body's still going to fawn. And to the extent that sometimes fawning can be conscious, like they're already sort of mapping out, like I'm going into the lion's den, right? Okay, so maybe you bring a little fawning protection with you. And it's different to me when it's so reflexive and it's 24/7 and it's environments that don't necessitate a fawn response. But in environments where it's not safe to bring my full self, to bring my full voice, to have external overt boundaries, maybe my boundaries become a little more internal. In other words, like I'm only going to go for 10 minutes and they don't need to know why or that it's even happening, or I'm just not going to respond to those types of questions, right? We keep more of ourselves for ourselves and we can kind of do it on the down low. To me, that's the sort of spirit of that question. It's like, I'm not asking everyone, go and take off all your skin and your sense of safety and go back into the lion's den. I'm like, no, a lot of us have to go back in, and we can, it's so personal. It's deeply individual. I say that this work tends to be very slow by design. So you can give your body little tiny doses of maybe having a voice or doing things differently and feeling a sense of safety. But particularly with the, like, you know, your biggest wounding and your greatest sort of perpetrator, don't have this expectation that it's going to radically, wildly change overnight. That would be destabilizing. That would be re-traumatizing. Hold on to yourself. In other words, I don't know. What do you think about what I'm saying, Monique?
I know I'm thinking about it in different things are coming into my mind because I've been on this journey for a while and
yeah.
I can remember. Okay, well, first I'll say that some of the relationships where fawning might have showed up are with people who are emotionally very immature. So it wouldn't, I couldn't explain and express myself because it wouldn't be received. So I like what you said, because it may be taking those small steps back without even verbal, but with boundary making with your body or with That's your right. time or something like that. And so yeah. I can remember there was a time where I was spending time fawning in a relationship where it was not, there was no reciprocity and it was just one way. And it was like listening. And finally I was like, I am not going to do this anymore. And I just needed to remove myself.
It's one key thing that I talk about in the book, that for many of us in big and small ways, we need to take some space from these relationships that trigger our fawning. And that could be 10 minutes in the car before you go inside. And it could be, I need to actually go away for the weekend if that's possible. But part of even just feeling into our own bodies, which are so attuned to other, is taking literal physical space. And I see just that one action really translating. And the second thing is, it's space to be able to trust our instincts, right? The person who wrote that question can trust that they know that they are going into the lion's den. And I think this is where so many of us can get caught and go, is it really a lion's den? I mean, I know they mean well and they come by these behaviors honestly and I have more healing. I should be, we self-gaslight. We talk ourselves out of our feelings. We tell ourselves we're being irrational. And I go, no. Listen to what your body is telling you. This isn't safe. And then ask yourself, what does feel available to me in terms of establishing even just a little bit more safety? And then that leads to some of these internal boundaries that we've been talking about.
I love that. Really good. All right. So let's see what else I have here. This is interesting. Does fawning always respond with freezing? I don't seem to be able to separate the two. They are one reaction to me.
Yeah, so this is interesting. It's a very nuanced question. Fawning, as we know it today, is a hybrid trauma response. So that means one aspect of fawning is that fight-flight energy. It's mobilizing. It's active. It's the part that keeps us in the world. We got to kind of show up, right? Day in, day out. And it's what we call hyper arousal in the nervous system. But happening at the same time is this hypo arousal, this down regulation, sort of depression or dissociation. And depending on the model that you're working with, some people refer to freeze as strictly this sort of hypo arousal. Other models put it kind of in the middle of the spectrum, similar to fawning, that there's actually a lot of activation, hyper arousal in the nervous system. It's just, it's trapped. It's frozen like a deer in headlights and it can't escape. For me, I see freeze and fawn in like that similar middle presentation. And I refer to that real collapse response. Some people call it that submit response as separate. So the question is like, what's the relationship between fawn and freeze? Is there always some level of? So I would say, depending on the model that you're using, there probably is always some level of a freeze in the sense that fawning is both active, hyper aroused, and hypo aroused. This is the part that disconnects from self, right? I'm so attuned to you that I dissociate from me. And that's why just about every sign and symptom of the fawn response equates to some level of self-abandonment. It's also, right, when you think about all the different possibilities that live in a person's body, where how active they are or how down-regulated, it's going to be different depending on the person. It's going to be different depending on the context. It's why fawning doesn't always present the same. You know, it also makes me think about that idea that people are like, well, I'm not a fawner because I don't care what people think about me. I'm not walking around smiling and making everyone feel better all the time. I've had clients come in and be like, I don't give a shit. But the truth is they fawned in other ways where maybe they were doing drugs that they didn't really want to do because it's like, I need this friend group. They are my identity, that kind of I have to go along to get along. Or they've even said, I'm pretending that I'm doing the drugs so that they think that I am, but I'm not actually doing it. There's this, they wear a mask in a different way. It might not always be happy, smiley, kind of good girl. It might be like, I'm going to also be the tough guy and act like the asshole who doesn't really care, but it's in service of meeting the same need. So that's a great question. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, you also brought in dissociation. And I think I did see some of that somewhere where somebody asked that because...
Well, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about that just a bit. So where does dissociation play? I mean, you mentioned it a bit into fawning.
Yeah, so it's an aspect of this hypoarousal. And so this is, I guess it's important to explore this a little bit more. It's why some people have no ability to see that they're fawning at all because the dissociation is so great. They really don't even see that they're being abused, that they're being disrespected, that they're in a toxic environment. The dissociation is so great that they privilege this narrative, either that they're being told, we're fine, what are you talking about? Or the fantasy version that their body sort of creates to go, well, it's not that bad, and surely it's going to change any minute, right? All of these have a dissociative sort of quality to them. And it's also why some people, you know, there's the story that I began, I also tell it in my memoir, but I began fawning with this story where I'm literally in the hot tub at 13 years old and my stepdad comes in. And I did have some conscious awareness in that moment, right? So some people might in different circumstances and some people might not. But in this case, I knew I was terrified. I knew I was not safe. And I knew that I could not act that way. That in order to stay safe enough, I had to pretend like everything is fine, right? Nothing to see here. So this level of dissociation is different. But this is also why I think it's why I lead with my story. It's why I so heavily go into the richness and the depth of my client stories. Because if you don't even know you've been doing this thing, you've been so offline, in other words, that you're like, what are you talking about? But maybe you kind of identify with some of the symptoms. Reading other people's stories helps your body to go, I know what they're talking about. I have that experience. It's like you start to come online by witnessing your experience in someone else's body. That's why I love teaching through story and not so much through theory, because you're talking to someone's conscious, rational brain and they go, well, yeah, I get it. I want to take care of myself. But their body is having a completely different experience. So showing what that looks like, how it looks like in different bodies and different contexts tends to illuminate that for the reader.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I love that. And it's so true. For so long, our thinking mind, our conscious mind has been trying to figure all of this out.
Yes.
And the body's like, the mind is like, okay, I understand, I get it. And the body's like, I don't understand. You know, two different.
Yeah. And I'll even say in my own experience, and I have a wealth of experience of looking now at how fawning has showed up in my life. And it presents differently in my body in different contexts. There have been relationships like with my stepdad where I always knew I couldn't be my full self. I didn't know it was called fawning. I didn't know why it was happening. Didn't really have control over it. But I knew that that was happening to the degree that I could. Other relationships, friendships, dating relationships, mentors, I did not know that that's what was going on. I convinced myself, no, they're a really good friend, or they have my best interest. What are you talking about? Perfectly fine. So yeah, it's like, it's a wide spectrum and there's lots of different possibilities along it.
Wow. It's so deep and so rich. I have a couple more questions. How do you not feel selfish as you begin to set boundaries and advocate for yourself?
My gosh, Monique, if I had a magic wand and I had the answer to that, this is the rub. This is what I'm going to tell this person. You don't. You are going to feel selfish. You're going to feel mean. You're going to feel guilty. These are the feelings we've been guarding against probably our whole lives. These are, in a way, really protectors, right? If you think from an IFS perspective, some of these feelings are almost protectors going, Ingrid, you're off course. Go back and do the thing that's always kept you safe. What are you doing? Right? So they're like telling me I'm being ridiculous or I'm being selfish or I'm being mean. And we have to not look at those as negative things, as reasons to revert. We have to look at them as signs that I'm probably moving in the right direction because I'm doing things differently. And when we talk about regaining access to our whole self, part of that is gaining the capacity to tolerate discomfort, right? That's what these things are. Oh God, your perception of me is that I'm selfish, or you're going to think that I'm mean. And does that feel horrible? Yes, it does. Does it feel particularly horrible if those types of relationships have annihilated you? Oh my gosh, yes. And what so many clients come to my practice wanting to know is, how do I trust my body? How do I know if I'm being triggered or something is happening in real time where something isn't safe? In other words, is my body just remembering something that was terrifying and I'm projecting it onto the present moment, or am I genuinely in a dangerous territory? What we're doing is growing our capacity to tolerate and hold and notice discomfort when we feel this selfishness mean. And then this translates to being able to discern in our lives, oh yeah, this is discomfort. The body will ultimately be able to know in the moment, is this a trigger? Is this, no, this is an unsafe situation. Does that make sense? I said a whole mouthful there, but I feel
What you said in the last episode, and I loved it, where you said you're asking yourself, is this discomfort or is this dangerous?
Right.
And tolerating the discomfort even a little bit is going to be part of healing. There's no way around that.
There's no way around it. In fact, fawning was our way around it. And so we are literally asking the body to go in a different direction, and it's going to invite, again, this is an extension of that clean pain idea. Like, do I like feeling that people think I'm the bad guy, that I've been scapegoated or even whatever? I hate that feeling to this day. I want to be liked. I want everyone to agree with what I have to say, like come for me in an aggressive way about it. But I can't really be a whole person in the world and achieve that goal. And so part of the work is going, yeah, you may think X, Y, and Z about me, but I finally feel good about myself because I can trust my motivation. I know I'm not doing this from a selfish or mean place. I know it, right? So we trust ourselves more than we privilege someone else's perspective or opinion.
That's something I want to highlight, that because it's so important and it's such a part of healing. It's also having positive regard for ourselves, something we lost that was, I think, a birthright. And so it's going to be uncomfortable facing that. But ultimately, it's coming back to our original design and our authenticity.
That's right. And this makes me think we're not talking about this explicitly, but I think this is an aspect of what we call reparenting. You know, you wouldn't turn to a child who came home from school and was like, I just said to my friend that I wanted to take a turn, you know, or that I didn't like the way that they were talking to me. And now they said that I was being mean. You wouldn't turn to them and be like, well, that is being mean, right? Like, how dare you assert yourself? You would turn to a child with this loving, compassionate, contextual sort of framework and probably applaud them, like the way that they spoke up for themselves and how they did it. And yeah, it hurts when people don't kind of respect our boundaries. And that's what we're doing for ourselves, right? That's reparenting. It's an aspect of it.
Yeah. Except it seems we have a lot more compassion when it's our child.
Night and day. That's why it's useful to even think about there being a little kid in the equation that you're relating to, because it comes like effortlessly almost. You're like, no, I want to scoop them up and hold them and tell them it's going to be okay. And so you go, oh, well, that's interesting. I wonder if I could apply those same ideas to myself right now.
Yeah. So good. Mm. All right. Let's see. Okay. Well, if we grew up in the fawn response, do we tend to do that with everyone in all our relationships?
I think it's quite possible for reasons that we already discussed. If your necessity of fawning came online as your brain and body were developing, you tend to not have a sense of yourself outside of that, right? Like, we don't know what healthy conflict is. We don't know what reciprocal relationship is. There's no experience of that in our bodies. And so this is also, you know, what we call trauma reenactment. But part of why trauma reenactment happens is because we have this chronic response in the driver's seat. It's a part of what's recreating these things in our lives. If my sense of safety, really the only sense of safe relational safety I ever had, was equated with being exploited or steamrolled or neglected, guess what my body seeks out in the world in order to feel safe again? Exploitation, abuse, neglect. I'm not saying that we asked for these things. This is not about blaming the victim. It's literally looking at how our bodies grow and develop. That my literal only sense of relational safety came in the face of these things. So my body goes, well, that's my greatest skill set, right? Those are my tools. That's my coping. Where can I apply them again so that I can feel that, like, I know how to do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we do it reflexively with people that aren't there to harm us. And when we experience new relationships in the world that kind of feel like that old cozy blanket from your couch growing up, we go, oh, I know this dynamic. This isn't conscious. I'm using language that sounds like it's conscious. It's not conscious. The body just reflexively knows, it's experiential. I know how this works, right? It's like round peg, round hole.
This conversation is so brilliant because, I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago and before, none of this conversation was available. Figuring it out in your head, what to do.
Tell your story over and over and figure out the behavioral interventions to go and do it differently. And again, 3 degrees in psychology, a private practice, you know, all of these things because of that pursuit. I was relentless. I went to all the programs and the weekend retreats and, you know, I've been hungry to solve this thing my whole life, right? It's funny. People say, well, Ingrid, how long did it take you to write this book? I go, well, you could say it took me 6 months, or you could say it took me 38 years because that's, or, you know, whatever the math is today about when I was in that hot tub at 13 years old. I have literally been trying to unpack this since then. Maybe I told you this before, but around that time, maybe even a little bit younger, 12 years old, I had my first research paper in middle school. Okay, my son is going to go to middle school next year. I cannot imagine him being in a frame of mind where this would be a topic that he would remotely consider. My research paper in middle school was alcoholism, the family disease. Okay, that's how long I've been trying to unpack all of these things that have impacted me my whole life, going, where do I fit into this and how do I solve it and how the hell do I get out? And understanding complex trauma and now the fawn response, I'm telling you, for me, is the key to the kingdom that finally got me out of that old broken or healed paradigm.
Yeah. And that's one of my reasons why I do this is because after the trauma, trying to get answers and figuring it out and going to specialists in psychology, psychiatry, waiting for like, okay, give me the answers and being told you need to do cognitive behavioral therapy. You need to think about the truth and think about what's really going on here and figuring it out with your mind. And And that's what you need to do. And I'd be like so frustrated because I tried and it's like nothing was happening.
You know, there's a story. I've never told it exactly like this, but it feels important. It's a vulnerable one, but I'm going to go for it. Many, many years ago, I was meeting with a therapist, like to your point, right? I'm going to the expert because I need help and I'm going to be more vulnerable in that room than any other place in my life. I'm going to like really show you my heart and my wounds. And I'm saying, please, please help me. And I told him that I had, it wasn't even a part of what I was looking for help with, but I had shared that I had pictures, like probably pictures in lingerie and things like that, that I had sent to a boyfriend or a potential boyfriend at the time. And then I was going on to say whatever else I wanted to say. And he kind of stopped me there and he goes, now, can you imagine, like, I didn't have a child. I wasn't married. I wasn't looking to have children. You know, it was a long time ago. If your future child found those pictures, like what that would say about you. And I was like, what are you talking? Like he went into this deeply shaming narrative about what it says about a person who would take such pictures and have them in their possession. I'm like, I'm not sending these pictures to the internet for children. Like it just blew my mind. And what I know now, and this is why this is such an important part of the book too, is that part of my experience growing up as being groomed by my stepfather, being sexualized very young, when I was so disempowered and basically was told explicitly and otherwise, your power lies in your ability to be a sex object, to be attractive, to be appealing in this particular way. Boy, oh boy, the fawn response goes, got it. Got it. This is the way that I can appease. If I can be flirty, if I can lean in that particular way. So part of my chronic fawn response, and I've heard this from so many clients in so many presentations, is this sexual fawning piece. Imagine if that man, he didn't have the information, but imagine, just look at the contrast now from like, what are you doing, basically, you dysfunctional slut? Okay, like I'm going, what are we even talking about? I'm trying to talk about something else and you're telling me how horrible I am. When really, first of all, there was nothing wrong with what I did. But even if you did want to expand it and look at it in this history of constantly leaning into my sexuality is the only form of connection as protection. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, if you find me sexually appealing, then maybe I'm going to be okay. I will arrive in this place of safety. If he could have given me that, it would have changed my life. And it's why I'm going there so explicitly in this book. I don't know where else we're talking about this piece, but how are we not talking about it, quite frankly, right? It's like women in particular, look through the patriarchal lens. Like we are absolutely second-class citizens. The men hold the power. Okay, so how am I supposed to dress? And then don't be too sexy, Monique. It's like, don't lead with your sexuality because then you're going to be shamed for that. So there's this like tiny sliver of space, which probably changes depending on the relationship at all times, that our bodies have quite frankly figured out like how to navigate. I go, that's genius. Don't shame me for that. That's genius. Acknowledge and honor the survival mechanism in it, and then be curious, is this how you want to live? Does this feel congruent for you? Do you feel like this reflects who you are and your interests and your goals and your values? I mean,
I love this, that honor the survival mechanism in that.
Yes.
That is so important to think about, even as we're reviewing things that we regret, things that we've done.
That's right.
You know, so, so important. And that conversation was just, it wasn't available. It wasn't there.
That's right. That's right. So he not only didn't have the trauma-informed lens, but he was also there to like, you know, be the expert on my life and tell me where I was doing things wrong in a way that I'm just like, man, can we stop doing that to people when they're Please. So vulnerable and asking for help?
Okay. I'm going to leave with you with two more and then, then we'll kind of close it, even though we can just go on and do a part 3 and 4 and 5. Okay, which we won't, but we could. Okay, so what does financial fawning look like?
Oh, gosh, that's another big one. I'm probably going to go
Is
off
it?
On tangents. Yeah, because I think it can spin off in a couple different directions. So on one hand, there's a client that I present in the book. His name is Anthony. as someone who was chronically invalidated in childhood, you're not enough. You're doing it wrong. Do it this way. Be like us, right? Chronic day in, day out invalidation. His body was like, okay, well, I better go to an Ivy League school and become a lawyer. And if I'm going to be a lawyer, I better be a partner. If I'm going to be a partner, I better be in the best firm. It better, right? So his strategy in fawning was like such a people-pleasing, seeking external validation in all of these sort of ways, where he did amass like great success. He had the house, he had all of the things. And yet he came to me in his mid-50s, not having a clue who he actually was, what he liked, what he wanted to do, hating his day-to-day existence. Like he was successful, right? I think sometimes fawning looks like success. It's like, I was a good kid. I did all the things. I showed up, right? Maybe even achieved some wealth and some success, but I've gone missing in my own life. So I think that's one presentation. The other presentation is, I am so missing from my own life. I can't even show up at all. It feels like I know that I have these gifts or interests or goals, but there's constant ceiling that we hit, in part because I don't want to ruffle any feathers. I don't want there to be too, like the need to avoid conflict is so great that we stay really small, right? And so we don't progress in careers or we don't go for the things. And so all of this translates to career and finance. And then of course, even just in regular relationships, this feels similar to the sexual fawning. If I don't have a sense of self that's just worthy just because, I'm always looking for what currency will garner me favor. And maybe it's sexuality, but maybe it's like, well, I'll pay for it. Oh, no, let me get the check. You have a need? Well, I have some resource. Well, no, let me handle it. There's this reflexive way that we lean in with money, even when we don't have it. Like people will go into personal debt. Another example of the self-abandonment that happens because we go, no, your need matters more than not even my needs, but just my wants, my right to exist in the world, my right just to earn a decent income even and be able to hold it just because. It's sort of like we can feel like we're a sieve. It's like the money might come, but we get rid of it almost just as fast because we certainly don't deserve it and you deserve it more. So money as currency can show up in all kinds of ways with fawning. And again, there's nothing wrong with being generous or giving all your money away if that's what you want to do. The difference is, do I want to do it? Or am I doing it before I even have a chance to think about it?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
All right, last one. How can we tell if someone is fawning with us?
That's such a good question. I wish I had like a way to kind of zoom in and give like a specific answer, but I think it's hard. And we've talked about, look at all the different ways that fawning can show up, that it's hard to know. I would say if you are wondering and you're curious, you might want to ask that person like, hey, I know you said like it's totally fine or you don't really care, but I'm wondering like if you did care, what would you say? Or if you did have an opinion, what might you say? Or, hey, I noticed that you're always deferring. So in other words, maybe you see a pattern of behavior that makes you curious. And then I say, be curious directly with them. And for a chronic fawner, they might go, no, what are you talking about? But I still think it sort of plants a seed, an opportunity for someone, maybe when they walk away to go, oh, that's interesting that they asked me that. Like, I wonder what I do actually think about that. And certainly as therapists, if we think that someone is fawning, we have to make a lot of space for them to go, listen, I don't want you to feel like you have to be compliant with me. I'm not here to tell you what to do or how to do it. You can say, like, if I did say something that offended you, how might you tell me? Well, here's what I'm open to having you say, even coming back and being like, Ingrid, that fucking sucked. I wish you wouldn't have done that, right? Like, we have to make lots of room for the possibility for conflict to make it safe, to go, it's okay for you to bring your full self here. So these are a few ideas that I think come to mind, but it's a It's a huge question that probably has as many answers as there are presentations of the
I love that. I love even giving the question, like, for them to ponder or think about. I mean, I think it's so kind that somebody takes an interest to even ask that question.
And, eliciting, you want to draw out more of the whole self rather than shaming the coping.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, Ingrid, this was so good. I really appreciate it. I hope that people will listen to it, maybe listen to it a few times. If you know anyone you can that you think this could be helpful for, please share it. Thank you, Ingrid, for your time with us. And let me show the book again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I hope people will get the book. There's so much more in there that we could never cover, but this is a beautiful primer, and I appreciate you having me back to cover a little more ground.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wendy.
Okay, I'm going to stop it, but then I think it might like cut us out. But it was long, almost 53 minutes. It was so good. I thought it was great.
We covered a ton of ground. So hopefully, yeah, there's a lot for people to take from
it. So good. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me back and all your support of this book. I'm so excited. It's almost in the world.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.